finishes off in style. A magnificent strike into the crowd. India lift the World Cup after 28 years.
Of MS Dhoni's helicopter shots, of Virat Kohli's screaming cover drives, of Rohit Sharma's effortless sixes, of Ravichandran Ashwin's carom ball, of Ravindra Jadeja's chutzpah, of Jasprit Bumrah's once-in-a-lifetime brilliance, and everything else in between and beyond the boundary of any cricket field. Hello, hello, and hello. Welcome to the second season of this cricket podcast, Hotspot. As always, I'm your host, sports journalist and broadcaster Chetan Narula. And first of all, I would like to take this opportunity to thank our listeners. We did 11 episodes in season one, that was 2019, the last of which came out on December 31. We have crossed 10,000 listens and downloads for that first season alone sometime in April this year. And we are indeed very grateful that you took out the time to listen to this podcast. Of course, since December 31, it has been a rather long break, but we are back now and as always, we will try to get you regular episodes in this new 2020 season. We want to talk about the relevant stuff on this podcast with people who have a good and sound knowledge and information about the game. And that is going to be the endeavor of this podcast, to talk about points of relevance. In these COVID times, we have been absent, obviously, because it has been a fight for everyone. Everyone has had to fight mentally, personally, professionally. So here is hoping that you are doing well while listening to this podcast, staying in wherever you are, regularly cleaning and washing your hands and, you know, staying safe in general. In fact, while listening to this podcast, please pause after every 10, 12 minutes and go wash your hands. Stay in and stay safe. And before we begin with this episode, I just want to announce a change to our regular programming. My friend and colleague and co-host of this podcast in the first season, Deep Das Gupta, he is no longer able to join us because of prior professional commitments. We had a lot of fun with Deep getting his insights and we hope to have him back soon, whether as a co-host, fingers crossed as a co-host, but sometimes as an expert as well. Now, moving on with this episode, the first of the second season, we have a very well-known and highly knowledgeable journalist, a treasure trove of information, really. He's also my personal friend and colleague, of course. And if you look at it from my vantage point, I personally think he knows everything that goes on within and beyond the cricket boundary. I welcome to this show with great pleasure K. Srinivas Rao, formerly of the Indian Express and currently of the Times of India. Welcome, Srini, and how are you doing? How the lockdown has been going for you?
Thank you, Chetan. I'm doing absolutely well. Lockdown is the same for me as it is for everyone else, and it's a pleasure being here right now with you.
It's been a rather long lockdown. Do you remember the last time, you know, cricket ever took a break this long? I mean, yes, there are always off seasons, but it's a forced break for everyone. It is something that is totally unprecedented. The last time sport, international sports, really stopped was the Second World War. So this is like an unseen enemy, the Third World War that we are fighting, a global fight that it is.
You're correct. I mean, I can't remember a single, window where global sports took an absolute break. I absolutely, other than, of course, what happened in the last century, where you talk about the Second World War later, but I can't remember of a single instance where sports has taken a backseat, live sporting action taking a backseat. No, this is absolutely unprecedented.
And whether it is cricket, whether it's Formula One or football has resumed in Europe and even in New Zealand, we've had a few rugby matches. Australian rules football is resuming as well. In different parts of the world, sport is resuming. Obviously, it's a high stakes game, high money game. And that is why, you know, the topic of discussion for this first episode is really apt.
Chetan, I'll add something there.
If
you look at the sports that are resuming globally, everywhere in the world, like you mentioned, the domestic rugby league in Australia or in the NBA in US, which is starting in July. These are all domestic leagues.
Yeah.
All countries are going ahead with their respective domestic leagues. So, you know, And there is a reason. There is a reason. And the reason being that these domestic leagues in their respective countries are their number one leagues, like NBA in you know,
the US,
the US, for example. Of course, it's the world's biggest property. But in the US itself, it is among NFL, MLB, everything put together, NBA has its own, place.
Following.
So
yeah.
These following. And domestic leagues are a window for broadcasters to step into back into this market, which has been a bloodbath for them. It's unprecedented. And so that's why I was coming back to the point that sports where it's resuming, they're starting with domestic leagues because it doesn't require a lot of travel. It doesn't require overseas people to step in. The logistics, the operations are far more, localized. So those things are falling in favor of these domestic leagues.
So what you're really pointing towards is a very interesting pointer, which is regarding the Indian Premier League. And later in this show, we will come back to that. But when you say all of these leagues and all of these various sports across the world, they are domestic leagues that are resuming, cricket is taking a different route altogether, because cricket will resume when England and West Indies take on each other in the first test sometime in the first week of July. So that is something really different. And that is why the topic of discussion, like I was saying, is really apt, because this is how cricket is going to function. This is how the International Cricket Council has laid down, okay, this is how you're going to function. We will also take a look, because Srini is here, we will take a look at how it is shaping up at not only the international cricket scenario, but also at the ICC. What is cooking there in terms of the T20 World Cup? Because if international cricket is resuming, then a very, very important event is going to happen or not going to happen. We don't really know. That is the 2020 Men's T20 World Cup in Australia. And of course, there is the ego tussle with the BCCI and the upcoming elections for the ICC chairman. So all of these topics, we'll try to get as much information as possible out of Srinivas Rao. He will only let us know. I can rest assured our listeners, he will only let us know what he wants to let us know. And on that note, Srini, I want to start in particular with this story that you did on May 29, which first appeared in the Times of India, which was regarding the ICC-BCCI email exchange about the taxation policy, which was regarding the 2016 World T20, which was the last ICC event that was hosted in India, and regarding the 2021 T20 World Cup, for which India are also the host. And of course, there was also a follow-up story to that, which was on June 11, again appearing first in the Times of India, where no call was taken on the T20 World Cup yet, but the ICC extended that tax solution deadline for the BCCI.
You know, there are two ways to look at it. Number one, yes, the ICC has flagged it as a policy that, the hosting nation, the government of the hosting nation is invited to, submit tax guarantees in exchange for hosting an ICC event. And that is something that's been in place, that was in place even when India hosted the 2016 T20 World Cup. But at the end of the day, it is for the government of the hosting nation to take a call on that. Now, in 2016, when the T20 World Cup was held in India, I don't think many people know this, that the tax guarantees that ICC had sought, India had still not given them a waiver. What India did, what the Indian government offered, was a reduced, tax bill. So if you, I'm sure you would have followed the developments, ICC withholding $23 million dollars, and obviously it has gone from the broadcaster's pocket. That money has gone from the broadcaster's pocket, and that money is due to be received by India.
I believe there's a pending arbitration going on about that.
Yes, there is a pending arbitration. There is a pending court case going on. It's a legal matter, and there's no point discussing something that is there in the court.
Yeah.
And it will come when it has to come. But that's for another day. The point is that in 2016, there are two very important things to remember. Number one, There was no complete waiver. What the Indian government offered was a reduced tax bill. That was number one. Number two is that the tax guarantee letters between ICC and the BCCI was signed less than 2 months before the start of the T20 World Cup in 2016. So when did the 2016 World Cup begin? I think it began in March. But the point is that it was signed early that year in January.
Yeah.
The tax guarantee letter. So what are we looking at now? What we are looking at now is the possibility of India hosting the 2021 edition. And why I say the possibility is because if this year's T20 World Cup were to be postponed, there is no final word yet on whether Australia will host the 2021 edition and India will host the 2022, or will India continue to host the 2021 and will Australia opt for the settle for the 2022 edition? So there's no final word on that yet.
Right.
But even if we were to assume that India were to continue hosting the 2021 T20 World Cup as scheduled, even then there were more than 15, 16 months to go before the event, right?
Right.
So what is the hurry that ICC is talking about? I would like to know, when did ICC sign that letter with BCCI ahead of the 2016 World Cup? And I have been asking these questions, and I'm not surprised that nobody wants to answer these questions.
And in fact, an ICC board meeting was rescheduled because they just said, okay, you know what, we need to first figure out how the emails.
Well, I can tell you, you need a Sherlock Holmes to actually tell you why are these ICC meetings postponed. I have absolutely no idea. You really have to be not in a position to answer to anybody to postpone meetings like these. You can't just keep on conducting meetings, postponing them without coming out with a proper official decision, something on which you've already made up your mind or something which has already been conveyed to you. For example, on the day of the May 28th meeting, I can tell you, I wrote a story where the chairman of Cricket Australia, Mr. Earl Eddings, he wrote to the Financial and Commercial Affairs Committee of the ICC, the one that is headed by Mr. Ehsan Mani.
Yeah.
He wrote a letter to them, listing out reasons, specific reasons, why Cricket Australia will not be able to host the T20 World Cup this year. And you cannot fault Cricket Australia for listing out those reasons. They have been very, very specific. For example, how does a T20 World Cup work, or any ICC tournament work? The hosting nation gets the hosting fee, right? The hosting fee does not go to the board. The hosting fee is distributed between the members of that board. So who constitutes members in Cricket Australia? Queensland, New South Wales,
different states.
The states are the members. So the hosting fees go to these members. So Cricket Australia essentially does not make any money out of it. The second way of income is the participation fee. Participation fee is which belongs to the players. The players who participate in the tournament. So where does the board get to earn from? The board gets to earn from gate money. It gets to earn from hospitality. It gets to earn from other local receipts.
Right.
And that is not going to be possible for Cricket Australia in this COVID season. And they have been very specific about it in that letter.
So this is a whole situation about the T20 World Cup, which we'll just come back as a second point. But as a final say on the tax matter, where does it stand now? I understand from your story that, the BCCI has got an extension. What is all that about?
So they've got an extension until December. And I'm sure we'll have another podcast in December by when I'll tell you that there's been another extension.
Another extension, because that is how the ICC and the BCCI acts out or plays out. Yes. Go on.
But what is more important here is to look at things in the present context. Asking the BCCI to give a tax guarantee 15, 16 months in advance to a tournament which you have not decided is going to be held in India or in Australia, which nobody knows as of now. And that too in the middle of COVID, where the prime minister of the country had just about announced a national lockdown. When was the first letter sent? First letter was sent on the 7th of April.
Right.
The Prime Minister of the country, when did he announce the national lockdown? On the 25th of March.
Right.
So less than 2 weeks after the PM announces a national lockdown, you send a letter saying that do you want the government of India to give you a guarantee? The government was busy in the middle of a lockdown.
Right.
And we all know what India has gone through over the last 2.5-3 months, like every other country.
And still going through. I mean, the situation in India is not really...
Yes. So what are we talking about? The ICC members who are gathering on phone, you know, even they can't gather in person at their headquarters in Dubai. They're gathering on phone and they expect the Indian government to leave aside everything that, you know, is going on in the context of COVID and look at tax guarantees for a cricket tournament. So it was that letter that they wrote on April 7th, which irked cricket officials, administrators in India the first time. Because the first question that arose in their minds was, why now? Is it so important to bring up a tax guarantee letter in the middle of COVID when we are not even sure whether this year's World T20 is being held or not? So why are we discussing next year's T20 World Cup? First, it is the ICC's job to put some clarity, to bring about some clarity about whether this year's T20 World Cup is happening or not. And on that, the ICC refuses to talk.
So I think here, Srini, we need to interject a bit and talk really about the T20 World Cup in detail. And for this, I want to take the attention of the listeners to talk about two stories which say, the first appeared on May 27, where it says the 2021 T20 World Cup likely to remain in India. And the next day you did a story where it, again, both in Times of India first, Cricket Australia wants to host 2021 T20 World Cup. The ICC says no decision taken yet. So where are we in terms of the 2020 T20 World Cup? And again, where are we in terms of the 2021 T20 World Cup? What is really going on?
Okay, Chetan, to begin with, like every country has lost out on a good deal of cricket, so has India. So the 21 edition belongs to India. So honestly, it is between the boards. It is between India and Australia to take that call. The ICC has no locus standi in it. So if India and Australia come to an agreement that, you know, Australia can host the 21 edition and India will host it in 22 or vice versa, whichever way, as long as both the boards are convenient, you know, I don't think anybody else should have a problem with it. That is number one. So that is why when I wrote, I said that, you know, India was looking forward to hosting the 21 edition because it is as scheduled. However, you have to keep in mind that Earl Eddings, the chairman of Cricket Australia, wrote a letter to the ICC, the FNCA committee, and he said that, look, India is having this tax battle with the ICC, where ICC has asked them for certain exemptions and India says it needs time to provide those guarantees. So what Mr. Eddings said in his letter was, why not allow Cricket Australia to host the 2021 edition and then allow India to host the 22 edition? So because that much time will allow the BCCI to get those required tax guarantees, you know. So what he suggested was that we allow Cricket Australia to host this year's edition next year. In 21. Now, this is as clear as it can get as to what Australia wants to do about this year's edition of the T20 World Cup.
Let's just take a breather here. So let's come out in the open and say, because nobody from Cricket Australia is saying this, because every day they're just talking about the Indian tour of Australia, which is supposedly in November, December. Nobody is saying Cricket Australia cannot host the T20 World Cup. Let's just draw a line there. Cricket Australia does not want to host the T20 World Cup this year. Let's just be clear about that.
Oh, yes. And that's why I'm telling you that there is a letter written by Mr. Earl Eddings to the ICC. And I wish I could have actually read out the letter to you. That in which he's very, very straightforward in what he wants for Cricket Australia. And he's saying it to the ICC in as many words that we cannot host this year's edition. And as I said earlier, he's very specific. He lists out the reasons as to why Cricket Australia cannot host it this year. And I explained to you, you know, about the gate money and the hospitality and where the avenues from where Cricket Australia can earn from a World Cup. I listed those reasons out to you, and those are the very specific reasons that Mr. Eddings has stated in his letter to the ICC. So, if you ask me, that decision is done. It's a decision that's been made already. What we are looking forward to is an announcement. We are not looking at a World T20 World Cup, whichever way you want to put it, happening this year.
Right.
It is going to happen in 2021.
whatever discussion has happened, whether it's tax related or whether it's COVID related, the problem here is international cricket might resume. The IPL may or may not happen, but what we can talk with some guarantee from the information that K. Srinivas Rao is giving us that the 2020 T20 World Cup will not happen, which means two editions in 21 and then in 22, followed by the ODI World Cup in 23. The question remains, who hosts in 21 and who hosts in 22? Where does the broadcaster come in this? Because Star Sports, obviously, they have invested so much money with the ICC. They are invested so much.
That's a good question.
Because they are invested in Indian cricket so much.
Yes.
Where does the broadcaster figure in all of this?
That's a very good question because, you know, nobody here is talking about the broadcaster. You're talking about a broadcaster who's invested $1 billion into ICC rights. All right. Now, here is something that is very important here.
Yeah.
Do you know that of the three ICC, so ICC's, the, you know, Star's right cycle with ICC comes to an end in 2023.
Yeah.
Between now and 2023, there are three ICC tournaments that Star will broadcast. So which are those three events? The 2020 World Cup, which is now not going to happen, that one in 21. And then, of course, the 2023 50 over World Cup.
Which is apart from the Women's World Cups and the Under-19 tournaments. But let's be honest, the men's tournaments are really the money spinner here.
Yeah. The numbers that I'm going to tell you now is going to be a real eye-opener here.
Yeah.
So of the $1 billion investment that Star has made into ICC, you'll be surprised to know that 45% of that payout.
Yeah.
45% is what? 450 million?
Yeah.
450 million of that payout, if you were to look at it as a $1 billion figure, of course.
Yeah.
Then 45% of that payout rests only on two events, the 2021 T20 World Cup in India and the 2023 50 over World Cup in India.
Oh my God. Okay.
We are talking about rights that were bought by Star in 2013. So right. Since then, what all have we seen? We have seen a Champions Trophy. We've seen two 50 over World Cups.
Yeah.
We've seen another Champions Trophy in 2017. We've seen a T20 World Cup in 2016.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If you put all these tournaments together, then 45% of the payout, of Star's payout to the ICC is going to come only out of two events, the 2021 T20 World Cup in India and the 50 over World Cup in India. If you add the T20 World Cup, which is going to be held in Australia, then that percentage value goes up from 45 to 53 or 54. So you're looking at an additional 8 to 9% of the payout, which is going to happen when the World Cup happens in Australia. So now you can imagine what is at stake for the broadcaster.
I mean, you're looking at around 8 to 9% when the ICC tournament, and I'm talking about the men's tournament, happening away from India, and nearly 20 to 25% or even 30% when the tournament, whether it's a T20 World Cup or an ODI World Cup, which is happening in India. I mean, it's staggering money. And there is no doubt here that it is Indian cricket, really, which powers the world economy.
Yeah, we generate the eyeballs. So, you know, and geography dictates a lot of things here because, you know, Australia, because the time zone that they are in, you know, I remember you and me as kids probably waking up early in the morning, like, you know, 4 a.m. to catch up on first session of a test match in Australia.
Yes.
Right. But we did that because we were passionate about it. The point is, at the end of the day, because of changing lifestyles and a very different and a very difficult time zone, Australia as a country does not cater to the subcontinent. Forget Europe and forget UK. You know, that is one of the reasons why, you know, it doesn't have the appeal. And India, because of the geographical position that it is in, if you take out the Caribbean, then it caters to almost every other cricketing nation. So that's the advantage that lies in India. Of course, other than the fact that we generate more eyeballs than any other cricketing nation.
And not just eyeballs, also in terms of the sponsorship. I mean, you look at any World Cup.
Everything.
Very interesting here that when you say that ICC's 45% income is just coming from two events in India alone.
Yeah.
And yet, the IBC, which is the ICC Broadcasting Corporation, which apparently, I believe, wrote that email to the BCCI, the angry email taxation.
I'll tell you, the email, of course, came from ICC, the ICC's legal team, Jonathan Hall. But, you know, the intriguing part in that letter? By the way, there were two other separate email exchanges. One was on the 7th of April. The other was on around 10 days later, you know, around 15th of April.
Right.
So I'll tell you one very intriguing part of that second exchange, in which the ICC writes in that letter to the BCCI, the IBC, and the IBC is ICC's commercial arm, which is the ICC Broadcasting Corporation. And the IBC is made up by who? It is made of the board members, right? The directors. Right.
Yeah.
So the letter sent by the ICC's legal team says that the ICC is denying BCCI's request for an extension of the deadline to submit tax guarantees because the IBC has denied their request. What the BCCI or what no other board has asked the ICC yet on a very official platform so far is there any paper or is there any document or are there any minutes to back up this line that the IBC has denied BCCI's request? There is no document. There are no minutes to any meeting being held. In fact, let me go further. I personally spoke with directors from four different countries. For obvious reasons, I can't name the people there.
Sure.
I personally spoke with directors from four different countries, and I'll quote just one person. Forget really the other three. I called him. I said, and he's like, Srinivas, what are you doing? And like, you know, thanks to you, we are the ICC have a lot of headache. And I'm like, I was very happy about it. And then he tells me, I asked him, I said, the letter from ICC says that the IBC has denied the request. Do you know anything about it? And here's what he tells me. The IBC had no idea of what this tax issue is between ICC and the BCCI.
Oh my God.
Two weeks before we saw the story in the Times of India, I received a call from one of the member boards who told me that the tax matter between the ICC and BCCI is going to become very serious. And I'm calling you to keep you informed about it. And this director told me, Srinivas, I had no clue about it. In fact, I asked him, why are you telling me this? And nobody's called it out. I would like to see somebody questioning the ICC on where exactly did that line come from in that letter that the IBC has denied that request. I have asked the ICC to get me an interview with Mr. Manu Sahani. They refuse. I have asked the ICC to get me a statement from Mr. Shashank Manohar. They refuse. I will raise this question now on this platform. Hope somebody can answer that to me. Who in the IBC denied the BCCI's request for a deadline extension for tax guarantees?
Well, that's a very, very interesting and relevant question at this point of time, because ultimately they went on and did give them a tax extension. Or like you said, you know, it's coming up in December 2020.
You know, it's funny that you make such a big issue out of it. You write legal letters, and there are legal exchanges, and suddenly out of the blue, you provide an extension for December. And Absolutely. You don't even state reasons for it.
Here's an interesting addition to this. The elections for the ICC chairman are supposed to happen shortly, and there are a lot of names that are coming up. The question needs to be asked here. What is the interest of the ICC and what is the interest of the BCCI? Is it with international cricket? Is it with T20 World Cup? Is it with the IPL? And at the same time, whenever you say elections in cricket or cricket administration, it becomes a game of power. It becomes a game of revolving chairs. I get this feeling, Srini, that here something is attached to the upcoming elections for the ICC chairman. What light can you shed on this matter?
Yeah, you know, elections are that kind of a thing. This is election season in ICC.
Yeah.
And whatever you're seeing, whatever is happening, a lot of that also has to do with the optics that go with any election, you know, optics, posturing, whatever you might want to call it. Because as I said, the tax guarantees, letters and everything, these were not so important. Eventually, they've gotten postponed to December. So are we saying that the elections are going to be postponed to December? No, the elections are going to happen. If not next month, then in August, probably. But yes, a lot of whatever we saw happening over the last few weeks were optics, keeping the elections in mind. Right. A lot of what we are going to see in the coming weeks is also going to be optics, keeping the elections in mind. So, yeah, the elections are something that the ICC members are looking forward to. The new chairman, whoever replaces Mr. Shashank Manohar, because Mr. Manohar has said that he wants to quit and he doesn't want to continue, or rather opt for a re-election. Time will tell what happens there.
Well, like you said, election season, there are a lot of names that are doing the rounds. Somebody threw up Sourav Ganguly's name, who is the current BCCI president, Ehsaan Mani. You had mentioned his name. He is probably one of the contenders. We don't know yet because obviously the nominations have not been filed. For the benefit of our listeners, Srini, can you give a timeline as to how the ICC elections are going to, if they happen at all, how are they going to proceed?
So I expect the ICC to come up with a statement in probably a week's time or maybe 10 days, if not more.
Which is the end of June. You're saying by the end of June?
Or early July, probably.
Okay.
July, you can expect them to come out with a statement where, sounding out the postponement of the T20 World Cup and listing out the dates and deadlines for filing nominations and coming up with a date for elections. So let's say how it works. Let's say if on the 1st of July, the ICC were to come out with a statement like that, listing out the deadlines for nominations. So probably in 2 weeks, there'll be a window of 2 weeks by which nominations can be filed. And then obviously there'll be another date, which is probably month end or July end or early August when the elections can be held.
Right. So July to August is the timeline.
July.
So July, August is the timeline we're looking at for ICC's new chairman. But the interesting point you spoke about there is cancelling of the 2020 event, that is the T20 World Cup, and postponing it to either 21 or 22. The interesting point here is the BCCI is waiting. You had mentioned the IPL. You had mentioned how different sports across the world had, started with their domestic leagues. There is no other domestic league which is more important in cricket today than the Indian Premier League. Because, come on, it's not a joke. 5,000 crores is what the BCCI earns from one season of the IPL. And you're talking about international cricketers, you're talking about franchisees, you're talking about broadcasters, sponsors, even freelance journalists like myself who earn just a little bit from the IPL. I mean, basically, it's a huge economy. It's an economy within a cricket economy. And the BCCI is waiting for the postponement of the T20 World Cup to announce. My question to you, Srini, how long is the BCCI going to wait? And when can we expect the IPL to happen?
First things first, you're absolutely right when you say that, IPL is an ecosystem that caters to a lot of people. And, it's not just the broadcasters, not just the players, not just the boards. You talked about journalists, you talked about media people, everybody. Yeah. But, it goes beyond that. You look at people who work on the grounds. You look at people who clean stadiums. You look at people who carry, look at the logistics for players.
The hospitality sector is nosedived right now because of COVID. So it might just
drop up
because of that. Yeah,
exactly. And it's a huge industry. So that is, yes, you're right about that. Number two, you asked me about how long can the BCCI wait? That's a tricky one, actually. In fact, let's connect the dots here. We just talked about ICC going through an election season, right? Everybody knows that the IPL is very, very important for Indian cricket and for the BCCI. As I said, the election optics. Elections are nothing but optics and posturing. So I feel there has been a deliberate delay in announcing the postponement of the T20 World Cup.
That's a big statement.
Because if you are sitting on an official letter from Cricket Australia, who have told you that they can't host this year's T20 World Cup, and with no other cricket scheduled during that window, what is stopping the ICC from making the statement?
Yeah.
My guess is what is stopping the ICC from making the statement is because if ICC were to make that statement, the first thing that will be clear is the window for this year's IPL.
Right.
Now, how big is the IPL? You threw a figure of 5,000 crore. Let me put it this way. How big is the IPL? Each franchise, if you look at the revenue distribution cycle of it, each franchise takes away nothing less than 200 to 225 crores per season. IPL season. That's staggering. And you can leave aside everything else. You can leave aside what BCCI takes home. Do not forget that every foreign overseas player who participates in the IPL, the BCCI pays 10% of that
money,
salary to the respective board. So even the boards earn from IPL.
Let's say Pat Cummins $1.5 million. You're looking at what, 150,000 payout to Cricket Australia, which will be very, very useful for them right now.
Exactly. Exactly. 10% of that money goes to the board. So that is big money. And you can obviously, you know, we all know what kind of demand is there for Australian players in IPL. And that is huge money for those boards. Yeah. If the ICC were to announce that the T20 World Cup is getting delayed, every player who has anything to do with the IPL, any administrator, boards, cricketers, match officials, you know, almost anyone is going to start looking forward to the IPL, is going to start looking forward to the dates.
Right.
And that is something that I personally feel has been a deliberate delay, because I can't see, so, or somebody needs to spell it out to me, which is that something that I'm not able to understand. Yeah.
Games in the power corridors of the ICC and the BCCI, never-ending games, this game of push and pull. But a very big, big statement there from Srinivas Rao that delaying the T20 World Cup, which obviously has an impact on the IPL, but I'm sure the BCCI has something up its sleeve. Very, very quickly, Srini.
Actually, that is something that you brought up, and I'll just say to you, okay. You know, how well is the IPL, how well is the BCCI placed, you know, you know, whenever the decisions comes, how soon can the BCCI organize the IPL, right?
Yeah.
I'll just quickly point it out to you there that the IPL has been a very smooth machinery from the year that it started in 2008. You know, in 2009, we all know what happened. There were general elections in India and IPL had to be shifted to South Africa.
Yeah.
It took 1 month for the BCCI to shift it. A one-year-old tournament, to shift it from one country to another, with the same amount of, you know, jazz that surrounds it.
Yeah.
So to put it very succinctly, BCCI has a very, very good operations team working on the IPL.
Right.
And given that, I don't think that it may take them much time to put things in place.
Well, one of your stories said that the BCCI is ready to host it in the September-October window. 30 to 35 days, UAE, Sri Lanka, everybody wants to offer to host the IPL. So if things don't work out in India, maybe they'll move to the UAE, because again, as Saurav Ganguly, the BCCI president, has already said, 2020 IPL, if and when it happens, will be only a television event. So you don't really need 8 stadiums to play it, and you basically need 2 stadiums and you are good to go. you basically answered the question for me, really, you know, when we can expect the IPL. Sounds like you're more hopeful for the IPL than the T20 World Cup this year.
It's not about me. It's you know, it's how things are going to go. As we said at the start of this chat, that domestic leagues have to signal the restart of sport in every country.
And that is the last thought from this segment, because we're running out of time on this podcast. We quickly move on to the next segment, a new segment in this new season of Hotspot. This is for the geeks, any Big Bang Theory fans who are also cricket fans. This segment is called The Moving Finger of Sheldon Cooper. You know, we shine the spotlight on our guest and they get to make claims. I mean, Srinivas Rao has already made big, big claims today, but I'm sure he has more to tell us from his past. You know, he's worked with the Indian Express. He's worked with the Times of India. He's one of the most prominent cricket journalists in India at the moment. And, you know, the claims that they make, they can talk about a personal choice fantasy 11 or look back at their past career and highlights. Very, very quick segment. And I hope you enjoy this new addition to our podcast.
The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on.
Right, welcome to this segment, The Moving Finger, where we have 3 questions for Srinivas Rao. And you told me that your first series that you covered was, what, way back at the turn of the millennium, 2000-2001, Australia's tour of India. In all this time, it's almost been 20 years, 20 plus years, in fact. What's been your favorite cricketing memory as a reporter?
What better way to begin your career as a sports journalist, than a series like that, Australia's Tour of India, 2001. You asked me for my favorite memory. A lot of them, but I'll stick to 2. The first test at the Wankhede Stadium, the one that India lost. First test match I'm from a city called Nagpur, and I had never ever traveled outside of Nagpur to see a test match. That was the first time, and I remember the day before the test match, when I when I walked into the Wankhede Stadium, and you know, those were days when you didn't have internet on your mobile phones and stuff like that, and I had no idea what was happening, and it was all very new to me. And I entered the ground, and there was absolute stunned silence. The players were there, you know, the journalists, media. There was absolute stunned silence, and nobody was. No, you know, the players were not practicing. Nothing was happening. They were all standing. There were discussions going on. And I wondered what happened. The news then came that Don Bradman had passed away. I saw a tabloid, a very popular Mumbai tabloid in the, you know, it used to come up with the multiple editions in the morning. So the one that came at 11 a.m., you know, it had a headline where Sachin, who was part of that team, Sachin Tendulkar, he had given this tabloid a quote saying, "I'm so sorry to hear that." And it was a headline, you know, "Devastated Sachin." And it made me think as a journalist that here I am covering my first test match. And I have absolutely no idea how this works. I have absolutely no idea how can I get Sachin Tendulkar to speak on Don Bradman. Right. And I don't even know how to react as a reporter as to, you know, the passing away of the greatest cricketer ever. So right. it was a very overwhelming experience for me. It was like I began to doubt whether do I belong here in this space, or do I need to really go back and do something else? Do I really belong to this space? And, you know, so that was, I will never forget it. I will never forget yeah. it. It's something that's going to stay with me forever. Yeah. And number two, which is slightly funny, that, you know, we were in Kolkata after we lost the first test. We had to go to Kolkata, and my editor, I told me very specifically that if we were to lose the Kolkata test, you will come back. You will not go to Chennai, because then the series would have been decided and that you will not go to Chennai. Yeah. So on day three morning, me and another journalist, who's now also a very senior journalist in India, me and he were covering the test match together.
Yeah.
And on the morning of day three, both of us probably came to a conclusion that, look, Mike, we are not going to go to Chennai, right? Yeah. So let today end. Let the day three end, and we were sure that the match was ending on day three. And we were in Kolkata, so I told my friend, I said, "Listen, why don't we come back, write our report for the day, conclude all of this, and let's go to Darjeeling for our short holiday before we can go back to our respective cities." So we checked out from our respective hotel rooms. We put the luggage in the room of another journalist and said, "Let this luggage be here because the match is ending today. So we're going to come back, pick the luggage, and we are going to Darjeeling." So it so happened that we came back on day three, and we said, "All right, no, it doesn't matter. We'll go on day four." And well, day four happened, and day four we thought, "Okay, today we're going to come back, wrap up work, and then go to Darjeeling." Okay. Day four happened, said, "Okay, doesn't look like maybe we'll have to cover day five. Then let's see what happens." What we realized at the end of day five was not just that, you know, the whole thing had changed and they were back in the series. And that we had witnessed something special.
Yeah.
But more importantly, we had everything planned except going to Chennai. And what I found myself was sitting, it was summer. Summer had already got on. It was on the March. And what I found myself doing was I took a 36-hour Coromandel Express, the train from Kolkata to Chennai.
Chennai, okay.
Without a reservation. Sitting in the general class, 36 hours I traveled to Chennai, of course, every single minute of it.
Of course, and I think every single minute of your esteemed career has been worth it as well, because like you said, you know, you didn't know how to talk to Sachin Tendulkar, and today, I mean, you told us how you get phone calls from the directors of the ICC, which is an astonishing journey, really. And in light of that astonishing journey, of course, is... you know, the second question that I have for you in the segment is the story that you did in 2008 that also highlights your journey. I mean, forget about the 20 years from 2001. In 2008, just in 7 short years, you were doing that story. Indian Parivar League, it appeared in the Indian Express. Our listeners can Google it. Special thing about this story was 2008 when... I'll tell our listeners and you can expand on it. Indian Premier League starting that year, of course... It was the first time someone pointed out a term which has since become synonymous with Indian cricket, conflict of interest. Go.
Yes, that story was a turning point in my in many ways than one for me personally, because I began to look for the first time. I began to look at cricket not just as a sport but as an industry.
Yeah.
It would go on to allow me to take a deeper look into other aspects of the game and not just what we see on the field. And I'm glad to have experienced that, because today what we see on the field is available for everyone to see, you know, with the kind of technologies and the cameras on the field, everything is available to everyone. What I have always found more interesting is to share with people what you cannot see on television.
Right.
Conflict of interest, yes, that's a term that I myself as a journalist had never heard before, you know, I began working on that story. So I still remember the starting words of that story. I wrote when Lalit Modi metaphorically describes the Indian Premier League as a family, he's not far away from the mark, because it was family, or rather it is family. I went on to write in that story how his co-brother-in-law holds 50% of a 50% in a franchise, how another franchise, you know, there are stakes which belong to his daughter, who's married to one of the stakeholders of another franchise. So
sure.
These were things which I wrote in that story for the very first time. And Lalit had lost it. In fact, he gave me a call that night, and he told me, Srinivas, I'm not going to allow you to enter any cricket stadium in this country. You know how Lalit used to talk, like, I'm not going to allow you to inside any cricket stadium in the country. And I felt so happy about it. I was so happy that I will not be allowed into any cricket stadium in the country. What else can I ask for as a journalist, you know?
Yeah.
So that was, that story, in fact, was an eye-opener. In fact, no media at that time was ready to follow up. You know, it's a remarkably shocking thing for me, because I expected media to pick it up.
Yeah.
Next morning, you know, when it appeared, and it was the front page flyer in the Sunday Express. And, you know, not a single media that I can remember, mainstream media, picked it up.
Right.
They did not bother touching that story until 2013, 12
where,
or 13, where, 1913.
Yeah, 13, 12, 13, yeah, where it all blew up, where it just blew up, yeah.
Yes, until then, for 4 years, the media just kept quiet about it. They did not do a single follow-up of that story. I, in fact, pointed out at least one conflict in every single franchise of the IPL. And everything that I pointed out till date remains correct. Truth that has never been challenged. In fact, I remember, the editor, I did that story for the Indian Express, and my editor used to be Mr. Shekhar Gupta.
Yeah.
And, he used to come up with this column called The National Interest. And in 2013, when the spot fixing scandal blew, he wrote a column in the Indian Express, The National Interest, which he started saying that, you know, we said that. We said so in 2008.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until date, I mean, we're proud to say that we were the first to say it, and nobody had managed to pick it up.
Yeah, just to interject here, listeners can go and check that story online as well. So which is what Srini is saying here is absolutely true. You can all go online, scroll his name, Google his name, and you'll find all those stories right there.
Yeah, so, you know, conflict of interest today has become a big talking point. It's you know, kind of now, I think, we have reached a stage where we have ridiculed the word term conflict.
Yeah.
Today, that word has lost its meaning. In 2008, when I did the story, I pointed out that conflict was with regards to certain arrangements that may have taken place even before the franchises had come out. And I wasn't suggesting it. It was by way of the story that I was bringing out certain facts, and those facts that were never disputed. But today, as I see, read, cover, or write about conflict, I just feel that the very term has been diluted. I'll give you an example. A cricketer's brother cannot be a coach, because that would be a conflict, right? Now, what if the cricketer's best friend is a coach? So are we saying that the cricketer may grant or take favors from his brother, but will not grant or take favors from his best friend? Is that what we are saying? Then what are we doing? Are we alluding to certain ways that we tend to believe and what we have concluded for ourselves. So conflict has become a very loose term today. You know, if you go into the BCCI constitution, you go and there is a clause 8B that talks about conflict. It lists down what constitutes conflict and what does not. Take a break, take one step back in life and think, can you draw a line and say this is conflict and this is not? I don't think you can do that. Just the way cricket's spirit is referred to, you can't draw a line and say this constitutes spirit of the game and this does not. The BCCI ethics officer has been a legal luminary.
Supreme Court perhaps needs to take a relook at this and say, okay, there is some degree of conflict that is always going to happen, and this is the extent that we need to keep, you know.
Yes. See, I find it absolutely ridiculous. Let's take this example. Rahul Dravid is heading the National Cricket Academy. Yeah. He's the director there. Yeah. When the IPL happens, why can't Rahul Dravid do commentary? I don't understand. Where is this? You know, Ricky Ponting has been a T20 batting coach with the Australian national team. He has been a coach in the IPL.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he's been doing commentary in Big Bash. You know, I can list out instances. Mark Waugh, he's been a chief selector in Australia. He's been a commentator.
Yes.
So I don't understand, why should a cricketer, somebody who's given his life to the game, why should a cricketer not be allowed to earn from the game? I refuse to understand that.
Yeah.
So these are things, little things, which have been complicated, not been touched upon, not been addressed. And I'm sorry to say, you know, like, I don't think the Supreme Court guidelines on how cricket should be run in this country, I don't think it has done a lot of justice to the game. One big problem I have, with the recommendations of the Justice Lodha Committee, was that India should have three national selectors. Are you kidding me? We are talking about a country where even if you have a dozen national selectors, even they would fall short. So where did these gentlemen get the idea from that three national selectors would be enough? Just because Australia follows that policy or England follows that policy? England is what? 1/10 of the Indian cricketing ecosystem. So I don't think a lot of mind was applied to a lot of decisions that were taken.
Right. So just coming to the final topic of conversation in this podcast, we're running out of time. Very quickly, Srini, if you had to list down, you've had a very extensive career. And by the way, I want to tell our listeners that, you know, he is still allowed in cricket grounds. He's covered many matches with me. We've toured South Africa together. We met in Sri Lanka. We watched some matches over there. And we've watched matches in India as well. So he's still allowed access to the cricket ground. Long, extensive career so far and, you know, made continue ever longer. Two or three instances in Indian cricket very, very quickly that brought about a change, whether it's for better or worse, in the last two decades that you've seen the sport so closely?
That's very easy to actually bring it out, because the first biggest change, and I'll keep it to the last 15 years, no point traveling beyond that, because we all know what happened at the turn of the century and all. But after that, I'll start with 2007, the most important phase in Indian cricket in the last 20 years, because in 2007, after we lost the T20, after we bowed out of the World Cup in the Caribbean, came back, it was a lousy window for Indian cricket. Yeah. And if you remember, one of the private media companies in India has started a private cricket league, the Indian Cricket League, right?
Yeah.
And it was the BCCI was staring down a deep, deep abyss, and they didn't know how they would come out of it. At that time, India's 2007 T20 World Cup win, which came as a boon in disguise, the permission to allow Lalit Modi to start and plan putting the Indian Premier League in place, I think changed Indian cricket and world cricket forever. What that decision to start the Indian Premier League did was it brought corporate India into the sport. It's not like corporate India wasn't involved earlier, but corporate India was involved in sport at a very very peripheral level. Like, for example, you had a corporate who would bid for a jersey right, or a corporate who would bid for apparel rights or kit rights or whatever.
Yeah.
Or
now title buying rights. Teams. Now they're buying teams. Yeah.
What IPL did in 2007 and 2008 was it brought that proverbial elephant into the room. It brought that proverbial corporate elephant into the room. And I keep saying this time and again that once an elephant enters your room, wherever that elephant tries to sit, there'll be some damage in that room because after all, it's an elephant. And the other one would be 2013, the spot fixing scandal and what all happened after that. Because what it did is, like in 2007, it brought corporate India into the Indian cricketing ecosystem. What 2013 and 14 did was it brought the Indian judiciary into the ecosystem. Once the Indian judiciary came into the ecosystem, it was the next big elephant walking in. When that elephant walked in, again, wherever it would sit, something would get damaged.
Yeah.
That's what happened. And we are looking at the repercussions until today as we speak.
Right. And finally, what's your third instance, the last of this conversation?
Again, I'll keep it restricted to the last 8 to 10 years. No point going beyond that. One of the things, if you ask me what has changed about Indian cricket, is I'll say Virat Kohli's rise as the captain of the Indian team. And when I say Virat Kohli's rise as the captain of the Indian team, I don't just mean Virat Kohli. What I intend to point out is the mindset of Virat Kohli, the brashness of Virat Kohli, which reflects in almost every other cricketer in the team. You look at the Indian team of this decade, and you look at the Indian teams of the past decade, there have been great superstars. You know, what Indian cricket saw between 2001 and 2011 will be unmatched for a long, long time to come. But what this team brought about was that dash of arrogance, the dash of brashness, and that I really don't care attitude, which I think has been a big, big transformation where Indian cricket mindset is concerned. Today, when we go and when we play a test match in Perth or Brisbane or Sydney or the Oval, a Virat Kohli walking out on the field is, I compare it to how it would be in the 80s when the West Indians would walk out on the field. You wouldn't want to go anywhere close to Viv Richards and Paul is mine.
Yeah, just a last interjection, Hamir. I mean, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Because you look at somebody like Rahul Dravid and Sachin Tendulkar. Yes, you can't, like you mentioned, you couldn't really approach Sachin Tendulkar.
Sachin Tendulkar that we see today is a very different Sachin Tendulkar than what he was in the last decade. Yeah. I remember Sachin Tendulkar you know, in 2002, 2003, 2004, when he used to walk out, not on a match day, when he used to walk out for practice, you could see him from a distance and know whether it was a good time to go anywhere close to him or not. He had that aura, and you really, you know, he had that mental barricade around him which you could not cross.
Yeah, but we're talking about a brashness here. I mean, is that a good thing?
Exactly.
This aura built on brashness.
That's why I said
it's different.
That's
right?
why I said. So those guys were like, you know, I mean, come on, Sachin, Saurabh, Rahul, PVS, they're from a different world. They're like, there's no comparison there. That's not what I'm trying to compare. What I'm trying to say is that these guys, the present team, they bring about a very different attitude on the field. And when you ask me what has changed in Indian cricket, I'm saying this that mindset where I really don't care.
Yeah.
You know, I really don't care. You come close to me, I'm going to give it back to you.
Right.
You come anywhere close to me, I'm not going to be very gentlemanly about it. You know, that mindset in Indian cricket, and it shows. You know, you have a cricketer who's picking on a commentator on Twitter. When did we last see that happen? You know,
never.
In the past who have had problems, but cricketers would keep it to themselves. You know, talk privately, settle it down amicably, have a private conversation, a chat about it. But this generation really doesn't care.
Yeah. Yeah. Just put your mind out there on Twitter and then let's see whatever happens.
Exactly. You know, so I see that is one thing that I see has changed tremendously in Indian cricket. That whole mindset has spilled on to younger cricketers too, who come in with that kind of an attitude and say, like, you know, kind of don't come close to me, Mike. Like, the same thing which probably Australia taught the world.
Hopefully that is something that augurs well for Indian cricket, because as and when international cricket India does resume, India have tours to Australia, England and South Africa. And, you know, yes, the IPL gets you a lot of money and a lot of eyeballs. But in the eyes of the fans, it's still victories in Australia and in England and in South Africa that matter a lot. Right, that brings us to the end of this first episode of the second season, the new season of Hotspot. My sincere thanks to K. Srinivas Rao of Times of India for taking out his time and sharing his valuable thoughts and inputs with us. Thank you, Srinivas, and I hope you take care.
Absolutely.
And take care of yourself and your family. And of course, I will be back with another episode soon, something which is relevant and crucial to the future of cricket in this time of global strife. In the meantime, do leave your feedback and comments, share this episode on social media, reach out to us on social media as well. We are now on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and TuneIn. So you can subscribe to this podcast, Hotspot, there as well. And of course, do remember to wash your hands and stay safe inside. Until next time, it's goodbye.
Dhoni finishes off in style. A magnificent strike into the crowd. India lift the World Cup after 28 years.